military's most elite special operations units. His class had commenced in D.C. practicing SDRs. These surveillance detection routes, both in vehicles and on foot, would be a part of every training scenario. Reese knew this was a skill he needed to refine. He was much more comfortable in paramilitary-specific training, the shooting and driving portions that the students affectionately called crash and bang. They went through 2 weeks of almost exactly the same static line jump training as the 3 weeks Reese had endured at Fort Benning, Georgia, as a newly minted frogman. Reese remembered his fellow jump students joking that the Army had managed to cram 2 days of training into 3 weeks. At least the CIA had successfully reduced it to 2 weeks. They had a week of maritime training, unarmed combat, medical training, and a SEER POW scenario that Reese hated even more than the first one he'd gone through at what was affectionately called Camp Slappy almost 20 years earlier. And they were taught the basics of espionage, disguises, working in alias, dead drops, and how to assess and recruit based on vulnerabilities and motivations. They were being turned into spies. The President of the United States has requested a meeting. His supervisor had called Reese into his office and, without even offering him a seat, relayed the information as if it were a common occurrence. Reese thought, requested was a strange word to use. Then again, who turns down a request from the president? Reese knew something of the new president's background, but had not studied him in depth, having been preoccupied since his return from a personal mission in the wilds of Siberia. He had followed the politics of the recent election because it was difficult to avoid, especially when one's girlfriend was a prominent cable news contributor. After mourning the passing of so many friends and teammates, it disgusted him to watch politicians offer hollow promises to the masses in a bid to continue their hold on power, most forgetting they were employees of the people as soon as they reclaimed their thrones. The helicopter banked to starboard as it made its approach, settling in through the trees and onto a helipad of bright green astroturf on the grounds of what was officially known as Naval Support Facility Thermont. Situated just over 60 miles from D.C. and located near the border of Maryland and Pennsylvania in Catoctin Mountain Park, the 200-acre retreat had been an escape for presidents and their families since World War II. Reese heard the familiar sound of the engines going to idle. He unhooked his seatbelt and removed his headset as someone he assumed to be a Secret Service agent ran toward the bird and slid open the door. "Welcome to Camp David, Commander," the man shouted over the still-turning rotors. "Follow me." Reese grabbed his pack and hopped from the bird, instinctively ducking his head as he followed his greeter toward a waiting golf cart, where another Secret Service agent waited at the wheel. He heard the whine of the rotors behind him as the pilot increased their speed before pulling up on the collective and rising back into the clouds. "Frank Sharp, Secret Service," the man in slacks and a light jacket said, extending his hand. "James Reese." "We know," Sharp smiled. "This is Agent Neely." "Commander?" Neely nodded. Reese looked around, taking in the moss-green hangar nestled among the trees, his eyes coming to rest on a flagpole with the stars and stripes gently moving in the breeze. "Is it what you expected?" Sharp asked. "Guess I didn't really think much about it. It's got a nice campground-type feel, but as you can imagine, it's a tad more secure than the average campground." "I bet." "Sir, I have to ask, are you armed?" "Pistol and blade." "I'll have to ask you to transfer them to your bag and leave it with us. You'll be meeting with the president alone." Normally being disarmed made Reese extremely nervous, but this was anything but a normal situation. "Of course," Reese responded, removing his holster and weapon from the appendix carry position. He wanted to ask additional questions, but held his tongue. "Is that the XL?" Sharp asked, admiring Reese's weapon of choice. "Yeah, I've been running it for a few months with the red dot, and I have to say, I'm a fan. I've had my eye on one, but the missus thinks I have too many already. I've refrained from telling her she has a closet full of shoes that cost more and all look the same. Wise man, Reese acknowledged, as he unclipped the Amtac Northman blade from his pocket. Mind if I wand you? Sharp asked. Go right ahead, Reese said, raising his arms to allow the metal detector access. I've been switching up between the XL and the 320X Compact, both solid setups. The wand gave a slight beep at his eyelets on his boots, at his belt, his watch, and his sunglasses. Thank you. Hop in, it's a quick ride. Where are we going? Aspen. What's that? Reese asked. The President's Cabin. Chapter 7. The golf cart wound its way through the woods on gravel trails. It felt surreal to be on paths that held so much history. It wasn't that long ago that the establishment wanted Reese dead, sending special operators and contractors to kill him. Now, he was about to have a one-on-one meeting with the man who currently led that establishment. They came to a halt at a cabin with the same green exterior as the hangar, a sign designating it as Aspen. A single golf cart was parked just steps away from the front door. Reese couldn't help but smile as he read a small plaque on its front. Golf Cart 1. Sharp noticed and said, That always gets a few laughs. 43 had it christened during his first term. The Secret Service agent led Reese to the entrance and knocked three times. Mr. President, Commander Reese is here. He turned to Reese. President Christensen will be with you shortly. We'll be close. Thank you, Reese said, as his escorts moved off down the path, leaving the former SEAL alone. Reese heard the knob turn, and a second later was face to face with the leader of the free world. He suppressed his military tendency to come to attention. Commander Reese, thank you for coming. I'm Alec Christensen. Pleasure, sir. Come in. I'm told the trees have eyes, he said with a disarming smile. Reese entered a room that reminded him more of his grandparents' house than a retreat befitting the commander-in-chief. I know, it's in dire need of an upgrade. Probably going to do it myself to save the taxpayers some money. Have you ever been to Camp David? No, sir, but I think you knew that. I'd also be remiss if I did not thank you for your service to the nation. Had you not saved President Grimes in Odessa, I might not even be in this position. It was Senior Chief Freddie Strain, sir. He saved the president, Reese said, remembering his friend and teammate killed by a sniper on a rooftop half a world away. A sniper who was still out there. The country will never forget him, Commander. Thank you, sir. I want to show you something, he said, leading the way to the outside patio of the upper terrace, a location that offered sweeping views of the expansive property. Are you a student of history, Commander Reese?
I like to think so, Mr. President. Reese replied, looking down on the pool below.
Beyond those trees, the president pointed, is Holly Cabin. FDR and Churchill planned the D-Day invasion over cigars and highballs from that very porch. In fact, the only reason this place exists is because Roosevelt's staff was worried that his presidential yacht was going to be sunk by a German U-boat. He was on the USS Sequoia so often they called it the Floating White House. Quite an appealing target for the Nazi war machine. In 1942, the National Park Service was tasked with finding him a more secluded location that was still close to D.C. So they found this old Works Progress Administration site from the 30s. FDR dubbed it Shangri-La, after the Tibetan paradise described in the James Hilton novel. Eisenhower thought that was a bit pretentious and renamed it in honor of his grandson, David. It's been Camp David ever since. The president looked back to his guest. Forgive me. I get caught up in how many decisions impacting 20th and 21st century history were made right here. The fates of nations have been decided on these very grounds. Reese nodded politely, recognizing that the president was not yet finished. Eisenhower put in the golf course that doubles as the Hilo landing pad. It's really just a driving range with four tees. The internet thinks it only has three. Shh, don't tell anyone, he winked.
Khrushchev and Ike actually stayed in this cabin. They watched westerns together, if you can believe that. JFK and Jackie liked to shoot clays right over there. Obama staged a picture there with a shotgun trying to appeal to gun-owning voters, but it didn't play well. Brezhnev almost crashed a Lincoln Continental while driving with Nixon around the perimeter one day in 73. Why Nixon let him drive is anyone's guess. Maybe his ego got the better of him after opening China in 72. Gorbachev threw his first horseshoe right here. Thatcher, Yeltsin, Blair, and even Putin have been guests. And now you. It's an honor, sir, Reese said, unsure of how to respond. The White House is for photo ops and press conferences. The real decisions are made out here. But you didn't come all this way for a history lesson on Camp David, did you, Commander? I was told only that you requested a meeting, Mr. President. The President tilted his head to the left, his eyes focused on Reese, as they might read sentences in a book, comparing the man to the information from his files. I'd tell you to just call me Alec, but I can't get anyone to do it. That's one order they won't follow. The President looked back out on the grounds of the presidential retreat and gestured to a fire pit a stone's throw away. In 1978, Anwar Sadat sat by that fire with Menachem Begin. Jimmy Carter played referee. Over two decades later, President Clinton would sit in those very same chairs with Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat. 20 years went by like that, the President snapped his fingers. And what do they have to show for it? Not waiting for an answer, he continued in a tone that shifted slightly to one tinged with respect. This land holds secrets, Commander. His eyes scanned the tree line. This cabin is one of the few places where my conversations are not recorded for posterity. Come inside. Can I offer you a drink? Whiskey? No, thank you, I'm fine, Reese said. Hard to find a picture of JFK around here without a drink in hand. Times have changed. Let me fix you some coffee. Honey and cream, right? That's right, Mr. President. The Secret Service has quite the file on you, as does the Navy, the NSA, the FBI, and the CIA. Reese's eyes narrowed. Fascinating reading. The President moved to the kitchen and dumped the morning's coffee. Are you surprised the President of the United States can make his own coffee? Well, not that you can, but that you do. Even more surprised it's in this old Mr. Coffee? The President chuckled. I like to do a few things for myself. They won't let me at the White House, but out here I can get away with it. Reminds me of a morning in September. The President's voice trailed off. Sir, I made her coffee that morning, you know. Who, sir? My fiancée, Jennifer. Looking back, there were so many mistakes. The coffee maker began to purr. I was working in California and she had a job in New York. I was so invested in my company, I thought we had our entire lives ahead of us. He poured Reese a cup and stirred in cream and honey. Thank you, sir. Do you believe in the deep state, Mr. Reese? The President asked as he made himself a cup, gesturing to a sitting area just off the kitchen. Sir? Sit, please. The deep state, or what people call the deep state, anyway. Do you believe in it? Now it was Reese's turn to study the man before him. He was shorter than Reese expected. His hair was cut conservatively and was graying beyond the temples. A dark blue polo with the presidential seal was tucked into khaki pants, revealing the physique of a man who still kept in shape, his eyes deep blue and alert. I believe we've found common ground, Mr. President. I thought we would, Commander. The deep state is real, though it's not what's portrayed in the movies. The deep state is bureaucracy. Power held by the few. The elite. The intelligentsia. It's our cultural institutions. Academia, big tech, Wall Street, Hollywood, even professional sports. I scare them. He paused. I wouldn't be surprised if I don't make it through my term. Does that surprise you? Not much surprises me, sir. The deep state is not a group of men in a bunker issuing orders. It's a remark, an offhand comment, plausibly deniable suggestions. It's donors, it's established media, right, left, and center. It's regulations and broad, sweeping laws. It's the power of the IRS, NSA, EPA, FBI, and your very own CIA. That's the deep state, Reese. I don't understand, sir. What are you saying? Are you familiar with William Ramsey's work on spiritualism? I can't say that I am. In 1856, he wrote, "One of the most striking proofs of the personal existence of Satan is found in the fact that he has so influenced the minds of multitudes in reference to his existence and doings as to make them believe that he does not exist." I found his work while studying the conceptual existence of evil after my fiancé was murdered. I was trying to understand and make sense of it all. Those words stuck with me. The president put down his coffee and moved to the window, his back to his visitor. "Can you keep a secret, Commander?" "I wouldn't be here if you thought otherwise." "True. You know, Ben Franklin had a saying, 3 may keep a secret if 2 of them are dead." "I'm familiar with it. The agency has an unofficial motto from the Bible, 'And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.'" President Alec Christensen made his choice. 9/11 was not just the work of 19 hijackers and a man hiding in a cave in Afghanistan. Nor was it any of the wild conspiracy theories you may have heard. 19 hijackers. I never believed it. The president turned. "There were more. Facilitators, enablers, financiers right here in the United States. The deep state, they knew we needed a nice, tidy list to appease the American public. The 19 hijackers were already dead. The public still needed a face, someone to blame. Someone far away. Someone who could be eliminated to make them feel safe again, to restore their illusion of safety. Get them back in the malls." "There was a hand at play, Mr. Reese, though it's not who you think." The president reached down and picked up a frame that had been leaning against the wall under the window. "Do you know what this is?" the president asked, throwing it to his visitor. Reese caught it. He looked at the commander-in-chief and then down at the document, encased in glass. "Don't worry, it's a copy. I had it framed when I ran for my house seat." "Read it aloud, would you?" Reese looked back to the document in his hands. "Public Law, 10740, 107th Congress Joint Resolution, to authorize the use of United States armed forces against those responsible for the recent attacks launched against the United States." Reese's eyes moved back to the president. "Skip to Section 1, he said. "Section 1, this joint resolution may be cited as the authorization for use of military force. Section 2, authorization for use of United States armed forces. The president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. Consistent with Section 8A1 of the War Powers Resolution, the Congress declares that this section is intended to constitute specific statutory authorization within the meaning of Section 5B of the War Powers Resolution." Reese looked up. "That's it? That's it?" 4 days after the attack, President Bush met here at Camp David with a group that would set U.S. foreign policy for the next 20 years. Cheney was already here. This was his much-talked-about secure location. Powell, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Rice, Armitage, O'Neill, Ashcroft, and Mueller, along with Tenet and Kofor Black from the CIA. All of them were here. None of the conversations were recorded. National Security Presidential Directive 9 came out of those meetings. It's now called Defeating the Terrorist Threat to the United States. The notification on bin Laden also came out of meetings with Tenet and Black. "Notification, sir?" the legal authority for our intelligence services to target and kill Osama bin Laden.
I always thought the mission was a capture-kill, Reese said.
A convenient semi-truth.
It was all starting to sink in.
The resolution you just read was passed by Congress the following week, just 7 days after 9/11. 275 words. It authorized President Bush to take us into Afghanistan and then into Iraq. Those words remain the sole legal justification to commit military forces to the global war on terror. It's been 20 years, Commander. Look at their intent. ISIS didn't exist in September 2001. Yet the language in this document justifies U.S. presidents to order invasions of sovereign countries in their pursuit.
Mr. President,